Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather round the fire.
It's time.
Or the computer or the telephone.
Or your car.
In your car. And listen, this is This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob. And we have a guest I'm so excited to meet.
Yeah, Bob is, I've never seen him bursting at the seam quite like today.
I have so much to say.
Our guest is Kitty Bruce. The book is How to Talk Dirty and Influence People by Lenny Bruce, her father. We are going to be discussing in detail the Lenny Bruce Foundation, what can be done, what she's interested in doing. The Twitter handle is at TheRealKitty, K-I-T-T-Y, Bruce. Website is LennyBruceOfficial.com, LennyBruceOfficial.com. So check all that out. Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation was created in 2008. It's growing and changing to meet the needs of its mission, which is helping men and women with scholarships for treatment and with education support for people who suffer from alcohol and drug addiction. And it's right up our alley indeed. And that, though, is just a little piece of what we're going to get into today. We got so much to go. So, Bob, I'm going to kind of let you drive the ship a little bit.
So, it's a big honor and privilege to meet you, Kitty. And, you know, I'm hugely influenced by your dad. Drew knows that.
Well, let's talk about that. What was the influence?
Well, my dad died when
Sorry, Kitty, we're going to talk about you. Yeah. we want to hear about the guest someday.
Well, I kind of briefed her a little bit. My dad got sick and died when I was, he died when I was 14, got sick when I was 13, at a time where boys need their fathers, right? Mm-hmm. And he was gone, right? And so right at that time is when the movie Lenny came out. And my sister mom, which is a whole nother story. I have a sister who's actually gave birth to me and was raised as my sister. My sister used to take me to movies. I think that was her way of being with Bobby, her son. But I always thought I go to the movies with my sister Nancy,
wow,
just her and I. She took me to see Lenny when I was 13, I think it came out in 74. I was
about
13.
Right. Yep.
I saw that and my dad wasn't around. And I said, I want the message of that rebellious stand up to authority at any cost.
I want that guy to be my dad. how was it?
So meeting the person who actually had him for a dad, I imagine it wasn't what I thought as a young boy. You know what I mean?
Yes, I think it was far from it.
Yeah. was he around? Was he engaged in your life?
My father was around in different periods. When I was two and a half, he was raising me on his own.
Yeah.
And then later on, he'd go on the road, and then I'd stay with my Grandma Sally.
That his mom or your mom's mom?
His mom.
His mom.
She was one of the first female stand-up comedians.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's interesting.
So he was in my life a lot, and he was not in my life a lot. He wasn't sometimes emotionally available.
I didn't expect that he was.
And,
but were any dads of that generation emotionally available? Were they, Drew?
Yeah.
Traditionally?
Well, not traditionally. My dad was a little intrusive. A little too available. Still controlling.
I don't think that he did... that he acted the way he did on purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of stress from his trials, I think fighting not to go to prison so he could exercise.
Not to go to prison, Drew, for saying the word fuck.
Yeah.
I know. It's amazing. What do you
think? That's one of Drew's favorite words, by the way, Kitty.
By the way.
Okay.
And why? I was thinking about last night as I was preparing for this, and I was thinking, why was someone on such a campaign to get... It felt like there was somebody or some group or some something.
The content.
It.
Here's it in a nutshell. My father was speaking about different topics that at that time period, people didn't talk about. They knew, but they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with now the church, homosexuality, freedom of speech, racism. Oh,
yeah, he had a lot of enemies.
Sexuality,
you got the,
generally.
You got the Catholic Church, the federal government.
No, I get it. I get it. But but he went sort of away, and they kept going after him.
Well,
and
no, so he could have stopped, but he wouldn't stop. And that's the message I got as a 13-year-old boy. Even in the face of adversity, you stand up for what's right. And everybody wants a dad like that. Do you understand?
Yeah, well, let's let the daughter talk.
I guess you don't.
So the point that I was getting to is that he made a lot of people very uncomfortable, and he made a lot of influential people extremely uncomfortable.
Do any particular?
So I'm going to get to that.
Okay, this is what I thought. It just seems so now, there's such energy going
okay,
on.
Okay, so you have him. Let's say he's in Chicago. Okay?
Yeah.
And Chicago is a very strong Italian Catholic place at that time. So now he's talking against the church. He's saying that, you know, eight people are living in a room, but the church was, you know, had gold everywhere, and he thought it was
hypocrisy, yeah. Which was his big thing. He could not,
he could
not
point
tolerate
it out with humor.
Yeah.
Right. And so the things that he talked about made people so uncomfortable in the powers that be.
Uh-huh.
And he got the wrong people. He got the wrong people angry.
Were there particular personalities? Or can you say?
Well, let's see. We'll start
J. Edgar Hoover wasn't a fan, I can tell you that.
No, we'll start in...
He had a whole bit about J. Edgar Hoover being a cross-dresser, and it was actually true.
I know.
I mean,
Kitty likes
if you want to go to jail, that's probably the best way to do it. J. Edgar Hoover, the most powerful law enforcement official in America... You have a bit about him being a cross-dresser.
Okay, so what I'm going to tell you is... Okay, so just give me... Because I've got the attention span of a gnat.
Okay.
So
okay,
work with
stay
me
on,
here.
Stay
work
on
with
point.
Me here.
There you
okay?
go.
He was in Philadelphia, and he was at a party. And my father was a very... He wasn't a yada-da-da-da-da-da person. When he was off stage, he was... quiet, a little reserved and shy.
Yeah.
So now he's at a party and they're going, Lenny, come on, man, say something funny. Get up, get up, get up. Say something funny. Do something funny. He stood up and he pissed on their carpet. Okay. And so,
that's funny.
So we just laughed 50 years later,
yeah. Right? So he pissed on the wrong carpet.
Oh,
because
that's a metaphor for his life.
He did. He pissed on the wrong carpet because the next day, like in the middle of the night, cops are busting through his hotel room door.
Wow.
And they're trying to arrest him for paraphernalia.
Not indecent exposure.
No.
Or but urinating in public.
One of my father's, I think, favorite for me that I think he was very talented as is that he could match up a disease that would correlate with the drug given for the disease. Now, he loved methadrine. So
what disease did he have?
Narcolepsy.
Oh, well, guess what? He also, not only was he a leader, what do you call it? Say breakthrough, the first, you know,
revolutionary.
It was the first sort of whatever that word would be pioneers in comedy. But many patients have followed suit. Many drug addicts have followed
his
lead.
He's a trailblazer in that, for sure, too.
100%, because that's now routine behavior, just like comedies.
Yeah.
Very routine the way he would have produced it, the way patients get their drugs.
Just a side note story. I had a kid, 20 years old. He's supposedly sober, went to rehab a few times. He's in sober living. He gets pulled over, stoned out of his mind on pot, and he gives his marijuana card with his driver's license to say that it's okay to drive because I have a marijuana card.
That's standard procedure, Bob. That's the first time you've seen that?
Yeah, it was crazy.
I had people doing that all the time. And the question is, the cop let him go?
No, he gave him a ticket.
Because he was too intoxicated.
They don't have a way of testing for it. They don't.
Yeah, but
California is nuts with the pot. You're out in Potland, USA. Only Colorado.
This is good. Potlandia, I love it.
So he had doctors that were friends of his, right, that would say he has narcolepsy, he needs this for narcolepsy.
He would, and then how he got around why he had to have syringes, he said the taste of it is so vile that it makes my stomach sick. I can't have that in my mouth. No, you can't.
And to be fair, the President of the United States was getting similar treatment at that time. It's true, right?
John F. Kennedy.
Yeah. So, well, for same reasons.
So after he got done getting arrested, then somebody tried to bribe him, and they just wanted him to be quiet about the bust.
Him to be quiet.
Yeah, and so he refused, and then he went to the news and starts talking about people trying to bribe him.
Who are the people?
The officials in the government in Chicago at the time. Mostly district attorneys, prosecutors.
Jesus.
So now
it's not
we
changed that much.
We rewind.
No,
it really hasn't. A lot of things haven't changed a lot.
But he was the whistleblower on society.
But what the point I'm trying to get to...
We're coming up with these great aphorisms today.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Kitty.
The point that I'm trying to get to is that he was arrested for his content. And obscenity law was the excuse that was used. It's sort of the same thing as Al Capone and tax evasion.
Yes.
Okay?
Content.
Yeah.
Obscenity law.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a constant.
So the obscenity law was the conceit for all the legal problems, but the energy behind it was coming from the people he was exposing.
Very much so.
And it sounds like it wasn't a conspiracy against him. It was more these individuals being offended by him.
See, but he brought a lot of this on himself. He had the option to
just plead guilty.
No, he had the option to cool it.
Shut up.
And just to tone things down. A district attorney in Long Island said to him, Lenny, if you better bring a toothbrush. And, in this town, you're not going to do this. You're not going to say this. That's not going to happen. We don't allow that here.
You know, they told him what not to say, and he would walk out the first thing
out of his
mouth.
Well, it reminds me of it reminds me of the Straight Outta Compton, police stuff that they'd come. They go, "You're not going to do this, right?" Yeah, they walk out. Boom! First thing they do, and that's sort of the nature of the beast.
And why he's such a revolutionary to comedy is because that opened the floodgates to
Pryor.
George Carlin.
I see
Carlin
and Pryor
directly related to Lenny Bruce. Yeah. And then everybody comes as kind of watered down versions of that. So there's the triumvirate is Lenny, Richard Pryor,
George Carlin.
Yeah. And then everyone else is just doing their bit. The same like your dad was in the beginning doing all the old bits.
He didn't do mother-in-law jokes. He didn't do ba-dum-bum jokes. And then there did come a point to where he said, I'm not a comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Because at that time he had things that he was talking about that really made him burn.
He could sew issues to comedy. The best bit in 59, I think, that he does a bit about VD. A little kid that's got VD is sweeping up the drugstore. It's really funny. Look at Drew's face.
A little kid?
He could make, 16-year-old kid.
Okay,
So he could make VD funny and culturally relevant because so many people were ashamed of it to go and get this thing knocked out.
Did he think of himself as funny, you think?
You had to pause.
I don't know. I think that what he liked to do was if he could break up the band, then that was good. As long as the band was laughing, he was good. And that's, I don't think he walked around.
Because they always had a live jazz band.
Yeah, I don't think that he, walked around being ha ha ha. That's not what he was like. He was introverted.
And what did you think? Is that you were in the midst of all this?
When I was, I think, 6 or 7, I was taken to see him on stage.
Oh my god!
And
oh boy!
So
oh boy!
Now,
did your mom did this?
No, I don't know who brought me. So
we got to get your mom here.
So I get there, and now, after the show's over, he says to me, "Well, did you like that? Did you think Daddy was funny?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, who do you think is funny?" And I said, "The Three Stooges."
Of course.
Okay. And then he said, "What's the matter, Kitty?" And I said, "You didn't even say hello to me once."
From the stage.
Because yeah. I didn't understand that he was up there doing
but
what he
that,
did.
That fits with the sort of general problem in your relationship with him. All that was taking him away from you.
Yeah. He took away from himself and me when it came to heroin.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next.
So we all know about that.
Well, no, but no, listen, but we lost, you know, here's
another one.
This freaking disease takes from us. Mm. And yet, it sounded like, how long did it take? I mean, how many years was he pretty heavy into his disease before it ended his ability to function?
He started out, I think, smoking pot. I'm not too sure. And then
in the Merchant Marines or something.
His favorite drug was methadrine, mm-hmm. because he could be efficient. He could stay up. He could think. He could write everything. Boom, boom, boom,
did,
boom.
Did he ever get a? And so he was on that probably for years, right?
And understand now okay. So Lenny Bruce is one of maybe 10,000 people in America doing that at that time. Now there are millions of Americans doing that with Adderall, college students. Yeah. Everybody, that drug is disturbingly abused.
I will give everyone a little break. I rarely do, but I'll give people a little break on that one. That's not as bad as the methadrine. The methadrine is hard.
Oh, it's not as bad, but they're
using
it.
But it's the same thing. It's the same phenomenon.
They're using it to study and go to school. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't know we needed that to go to school and study. I didn't have it.
So when he...
But if they had had
it. When he had to come down...
Could have been a doctor.
You guys are rough. You guys are a rough room. When he started to come down, he would take heroin.
Really?
And then
that progressed.
Then
I'm sure.
That would progress. Yeah. He loved to get high. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. He said that heroin was like kissing God.
Mm. Can't say I disagree.
So, you know, that went on for a very
Problem
long
is
time.
God knocks you down on your ass with it, too.
Well, false gods, mm-hmm. right? So your mom, let's tell people the story about your mom. How did they meet?
My mother and father met in Baltimore at the Club Charles. She was stripping, and he was doing a club down the street. And... at 2-3 in the morning, show people would go and they would have coffee and breakfast and bop, bop, boop. And that's where they saw each other. And the story goes, my mom told me that they saw each other and nobody saw them for like 3 days. Mm-hmm. It just disappeared. She wasn't stripping. He wasn't doing his comedy. And they were up in the bedroom ordering Chinese and hanging out. Mm-hmm. And it was that fast.
And did they stay together from then on, or was it on-off?
They had an on-off relationship because my mother's ability to... First, she blamed him. She blamed him
for
her taking heroin.
Oh.
That it was his fault.
And there's a double bind there. Can I kind of clarify for Drew? She got the blame for his drug addiction, but it was actually the other way around.
Right.
How fucked and angry would you be?
Right. Well, but it's...
Do you know what I mean? Certainly in the movie, she does get the blame.
Well, you know why? Because my father's mother was one of the... Well, there's a reason for this, Bob.
Well, it's that's because, blame.
Yeah, it's because my father's mother, my grandma Sally, had a large part in that film as far as being a consultant. Mm-hmm. So you take a Jewish mother... who's got a heroin addict for... Oh, wait a second. She said he was a social user. Yeah, a social user.
So it had to be somebody else's fault that things went so poorly.
You know, so...
What was his dad like?
My grandfather was a British Jew. He was a
military?
Bigot. He was a bigot. Yeah. He was in the military.
I just get the feeling that there was somebody beaten on your dad with a military
thing. My father
was
always in search of an attaboy.
Yeah,
that's what he really wanted. He said one time,
"It's a little bit of a Jewish thing."
He said, "You know," he said, "when a kid says, you know, Ma, I want a glass of water," he He said, they don't want the water. They want the hand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. So he's a very sensitive man.
Extremely sensitive. Very sensitive.
I would always thought he'd be harsh, but he's very sensitive. That turn is the opposite.
He had bits. Drew, I got to get you the DVD, the CD collection. He had bits about divorce in 1961 about get the kid. The kid is the whole thing.
Yeah. It's the truth. That's what they did, though.
Did you go with him?
I was used as a pawn.
Oh.
But not in an old victim way. It's just he felt that my mother was incapable and an unfit mother, so they went to court. And now...
And they had a strange thing where they were performing together for a long time, where he was stripping and he was...
The minute that ring went on the finger... And they were married.
He didn't want her to see.
Okay, there was nobody going to see his wife. That was it.
That's a pretty standard move.
So that was the end of that.
No, but I mean, every guy that I've ever talked to who dated a stripper is like, I can handle it, man. I can handle it.
Yeah.
No.
We're not doing that.
And so then they became a double act, and she would sing and he would do comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he wanted to go to California and he wanted to write scripts. And
was there a real opportunity for that?
Really? At the time, there was. And then somehow he just morphed into into being Lenny Bruce. One of the reasons
because
that...
He was trying to write and get writing jobs, but then he was doing stand-up at jazz clubs.
Oh, so it
and
became,
that's where it began.
Became a thing.
He would say, you know, when you're in a jazz club, it's a bunch of drug addicts and ne'er-do-wells in Hollywood. And he would say shit that just blew the band's mind and like, I can't believe you just said that. And he started getting into it.
Well, he was saying things and that he could say because the audience wasn't listening. They were going, also, bring on Tootsie on.
Was it a mixed race audience?
Yeah.
So that's interesting, right? And he's a Jew at the time.
There was a real tie between the African-American community and the Jewish community.
Oh, for sure.
Here's the deal. When he went to war, there was black blood spilled. Okay, Italian blood, Jewish blood. He comes back to the States. He goes to sit at a counter, and there's a sign saying for whites only.
The Jim Crow stuff.
No coloreds. And he was infuriated.
Yeah.
So as a result, he started doing bits about racism.
Yeah.
And it's 50 years later, and you know what? It's the same. Man, it's just the faces have changed, but the story is the same, and the faces have changed.
And so Lenny Bruce was talking about this stuff in 1959, Drew.
Yeah. No, listen, I'm aware. I didn't know you were a Lennyologist, though.
Yeah. So let me tell you some fun stories. You want to lighten everything up for a minute?
And then we will get into addiction and the foundation. We got a lot to get through, kiddo.
Everyone I know loves your dad. A lot of my friends, the Chili Peppers and musicians and Perry Farrell, we all love your dad.
They strangely, you know what's interesting?
It appealed to rock musicians
so much.
I'm going to
tell you, Bob. He was the first rock musician. He was the first rock star.
Well, how do you define that?
He got on a stage and did whatever the F
you.
He wanted. Yeah. And then the music became the standard bearer of that.
John Lennon, and now comedy's back.
Comedy's back again.
Yes.
In a weird way, it's sort of being the standard bearer of social
comedy. But
who is
that person now? Chris Rock? I don't know who that person
Louis C.K.?
is. Louis?
Mark, maybe? Mark Maron? I mean, these guys are all comedians. They're all carrying.
So anyways, let me tell you this funny story. So John Frusciante, the Chili Peppers guitar player, he was 19 years old when he became a multimillionaire. And he bought this house on Hollywood Boulevard. And then
you didn't burn that one down too, did you?
That's the one we burned down.
We?
Well, I was supposed to look after him, and it went terribly wrong. But that's not the point of this story. So I, you know, knew about your dad so much, and I said, you know, I think Lenny Bruce's house is around here somewhere. So we went walking around, me, Flea, and John, kind of in a drug haze,
looking for your dad's house,
and we found it, and we rang the buzzer and said, it's the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Can we come inside and look at the house? And it was Yakov Smirnoff owned the house.
Wow. Did you know that?
The comedian Yakov Smirnoff bought your dad's house.
Does he understand? Is that why he bought it?
I think so, but he wouldn't let us in.
He's a smart guy.
He wouldn't let us in.
That house has had a turnover of some of the most interesting people. There was a guy by the name of Charles Tracy, and I think that either he was a he said that he had has a room for my father downstairs, that that was where my father was, and it was just, it seems that nobody ever stayed in that house for too long. I don't.
Where
it's on Hollywood Boulevard, but
8825 yeah, Hollywood yeah. Boulevard.
Hollywood,
it's on.
Hollywood Boulevard starts again at Crescent Heights. Oh, it runs through the hills.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, all yeah. the way up in the Hollywood Hills.
Oh, yeah, up there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
That's a nice area.
Oh, it was beautiful. Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at that time, we lived across the street from Tuesday Weld and the rifleman, Chuck Connor.
Chuck Connor.
And his mother lived across
and
the,
his mother
yeah
how weird is that
and lived
maybe
across,
he just kept her clothes kept her, you know. I mean you know what I mean they just sick or something. I don't know, I'm trying to understand.
It's a beard, Drew.
Look, you're in your friends. I'm glad you didn't burn his house down.
He was so, Chuck Connor was gay, was he?
I don't know. I think maybe he was an interesting guy. He played on the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know that, Chuck Connor?
I did not yeah, know yeah. that. Gee, there's so much interesting stuff that if you don't pay
attention. I was sitting in my bedroom a nerdy kid for 15 years. You know what I mean? I know a lot of shit about stuff. I read a lot of stuff as a kid. Because when as my family fell apart, I just retreated to my room and listened to records
give me
read books.
Let's do a minute on Aloe Recovery House.
Aloe?
Tell Kitty about that.
Well, that's this place. So Drew and I had a rehab center. I don't know if you know our history. We had a rehab. He had it for 10 years before I was there. Then we had
then
it for years and years.
I stole it from somewhere else. And
yeah.
Then.
And then we started noticing, you know, we always had a waiting list and there was people and every bed was full. All of a sudden, it was just got less and less and less. And we started hearing about Malibu. There's these rehab centers in Malibu.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, fuck Malibu. Then when we started getting like half census and half to float stuff, I was like, what the hell is going on in Malibu? So I went out there and it's all kind of assy, kissy, everything that you would think, you know, you know, swimming pools and movie stars. So after we ended
it's all
our
Beverly Hillbillies out there?
Huh?
Only Beverly Hillbillies?
Go ahead. But after we ended having our rehab, I tried to start one in Hollywood and nobody came. They all want to go to Malibu.
That's because so. They were all with high. So he had a party and nobody came.
Yeah, I had a rehab and nobody came. So I got involved with these guys who had a sober living in Malibu. And I said, you know, and they wanted to start a rehab. And I said, what if we started a real traditional, like how it should be done rehab in Malibu for affordable cost?
Thank you.
We would kill it.
Yeah, both sort of... priorities, meaning standard
real treatment.
We call it, you know, 12-step facilitated with medical management.
Yeah,
you said I said something about medical.
Yeah, we were worried that you were suggesting Suboxone. No Suboxone.
Yeah, but you have medical management.
Yeah, yeah, psychiatrists and doctors.
If you have medical needs, whether it's withdrawal or psychiatric issues or post-acute withdrawal.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
handle
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And you do. What I was asking about was whether you do other sort of professional services like cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, CBT. We have a whole... Yeah.
It's so simple.
We have real doctors of psychology, not just people from AA making $20 an hour. Yeah. It's real treatment in the heart, in the belly of the beast in Malibu. And I would love for you to come and meet everybody.
I would love to come see it, too.
I know how much you're interested in treatment, and we can maybe switch gears now and talk about what Kitty's doing.
We will, but you mean no but, rock therapy? Or
No. There is a thing once a month that we do a sweat lodge, but you know, that's pretty fun.
Do you do it with
I haven't done it yet. I always say I'm going to do the next one. I've never
do you
done
do it with
that.
A Native American like shaman or something? Or?
Yeah, there's a guy that's has a place up there in the Frank Lloyd Wright property up there, you know, in Malibu.
I don't know.
They do these hippie stuff.
But we also support social model treatment, which is sort of the new, like Jason Waller's place.
Long term, independently.
Would you like to know what I think about this and what I did?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought when I first got clean that somebody should have given me like a how-to guide. And when I went into a supermarket, and I had to make a choice between Campbell's soup or another kind of soup.
Cheaper soup.
Overwhelming.
I was so overwhelmed because my brain was usually only had three thoughts. Do I have enough? Where can I get it? And when, you know, and when?
Am I high? Yeah.
So it came to mind to me, okay, you know what? So if incarceration or in a rehab, when you only have three thoughts... and then you're going to get another set of three thoughts, and your brain isn't, it's not working, it's not functioning. People needed to be taught how to use their brain. So what I did was I opened up Lenny's house, and it was a 16-room place.
Where?
And in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, of all places.
Five minutes from my house, mm-hmm. And it was gorgeous, gorgeous. And so for every paying client, and first of all, it's obscene to me, obscene.
The payments. Yeah, it's crazy.
What could you possibly be doing? 30,000, 60,000, they're out of their minds.
The other part about that first 6 to 12 months is you don't even remember what the hell's going on after, you know, when you get out of it. The first three months
you don't remember hardly at all. Yeah. Well, post-acute was
here's
done.
My experience with what happened. So I thought that if I felt this way, I bet you there was a lot of other people that felt this way. So I started the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation. And my main goal was to be able to help women in early recovery and teach them how to use their mind, what to do with idle time.
Mm-hmm. Kitty, we always said we got to take them just to get a driver's license.
Yes.
You know, how do you get take a driver's
a bus.
License? Yeah,
And I found that they didn't know how to take a bus or didn't know how to grocery shop. Simple skills like that.
Or if they had the skill set, they were too overwhelmed to actualize them.
So
millennials really have never done those things, but there's another generation of 35 to 45 that really have forgotten how to do that.
Yeah.
So right? what I need to tell you is that the module worked. It was a four-month stay.
Yeah,
the first month was habitual meetings, get up, go to the gym, go to yoga, then the second and third month was being able to balance out meetings and work.
When did you set this up?
2008? I bought it, and I know it took me a couple of years to get the 501c3 non-for-profit.
This is you are
yeah. This
you are
is what we've
our
been
song.
Talking
well,
about.
Well, see, this is why I'm.
It's what treatment needs to
no,
be.
No, but this is what I'm trying to tell you. I've been wanting to see the both of you for a really long time,
I know.
And it's because I thought, okay, if I could take this module and bring a couple of these thoughts that work, you know, maybe there would be some kind of.
You got to get her together with Jason, too, Waller, because Jason has had a very similar experience as a young male coming to the same exact conclusion you came to and has actualized a little program around the same kind of modeling.
With women, the ratio for one man, it's easier to take care of one man than seven women because there's so... No, this is true. And I couldn't figure out why there weren't any recovery houses for women. And I found out why.
They're hard.
They're tough. Yeah. They're either moaning, I don't feel like getting up. I don't want to do this. It just...
Well, the real drama, the fighting and the drama.
The fighting and a lot of the...
It's very easy for women to get the same kind of a buzz from drama that they got from drugs. So they'll create drama. No fault of theirs. It's just
no,
part of
it's just I just yeah. That's how it was.
And
but,
see, and you had an all women's center, right? What happens when you put most treatment centers nowadays are co-ed, which I'm not really crazy about.
That makes
the women focus on the men.
Here's a reason for that, and I'm going to tell you why. I sat them down. I said, "Ladies, I want to tell you a couple things that is what's going to happen. Okay, your menstrual cycle is going to come back." Okay,
we're all going to do it together.
No, because the menstrual cycle stops
the opiates,
and skips.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I said, so
alcohol
that's,
and opiates too.
That's going to come back.
Yeah.
You are going to want to. If a tree is over there, you're going to want to marry it. You want to hug it. You're going to go to bed with that tree, and it's the best tree you have. You want to take that tree home to your parents and invite the tree.
That's not an insight. Yeah, it's perfect. It's not an insight I've heard really, but it's right.
So I've hip them to what was going on, you know, and teaching them to communicative skills.
We would always say, well, their sex and love addiction will come out. That's what we sort of. That's the language we.
No.
you.
No, they've been shut down. Their hormones, they haven't had anything.
She's being more primal, Drew.
I'm the biologist. She's right.
It got sealed up for a long time, and then all of a sudden it was like, let me out.
Hello, ladies.
So she's right. You know, and
and then we have a bunch of predatory men in a place with people, women behaving like that, and it's not good.
So my hope is that so now we do fundraising for scholarships for people who cannot afford or don't have the insurance.
We got to do something about that piece. Nationally.
Yeah, insurance needs to pay for the treatment that the clinicians think is valuable instead of what they think they should have.
Stop it, Bob.
Because I guarantee you, they want them sitting in a group talking about their belly buttons, and we can charge $150.
But that's what I'm saying. You're living in a fantasy land. The insurance companies, no. But we have to find a way.
I think it's a go back to cash, a little bit of treatment, a little bit of cash.
I like the 401c3 idea that these are, and you can then fundraise around it.
Because I could, my thing was I'd get, I think the most we ever charged was $3,500 a month, and we covered.
That was us too, right?
Everything.
Like, how much should we do for a month?
Initially, it was $7,200 for 28 days at Breyer.
28 days. But that was with full medical model.
They had everything. I took them to see the Rockettes. I took Joe. We were going.
I'm sure.
And I wanted to stimulate their minds.
Are you people working with you? Do you have other counselors and things?
Lenny's house had to close in 2014 for the very reason I do not belong in administration. because I scholarshiped too many people.
Yeah, yeah. That's why we're out of business.
That's why
our hospital didn't want us there because it was too expensive.
That. Yeah. So now that I've gotten a different view, but the same module, I think that it works.
Yeah.
And it does work.
Oh, there's no doubt it works.
You know, and,
no doubt it works. And
well, let me
I
tell
believe
you.
That new the way to get see because we're dealing with such an epidemic right now.
Oh my God!
Such an epidemic that we need a sure shot way, and so.
Well, but Kitty, I'm going to caution you. There are no sure shot ways.
No,
what people want is a sure shot way, and that's
they want a bow and we're going to give Binky back.
Yeah,
no, it's not happening. So, you know, that's not going to happen. But what I can tell you is because we're living in such a pharmaceutical age, there's stuff being made that can't be tested fast enough. So it has to, and I think whatever administration, whoever it is going to be aware that they need funding because this is,
well, maybe it can be administered on a bigger scale or something so it can allocate, you know, I don't know, something. I'll have to think about this.
Well, it's going to be a jigsaw puzzle is what I think. Right now, the industry is in a shambles in a time of great
need.
Upheaval and need.
But the thing is, it shouldn't be. I went to an interventionist thing in Florida at the
training?
Breakers.
A training?
No, it was a place where all the interventionists went around to each center. They had
marketing
people. They had for eating disorders are over there.
That's
sexual
all.
Addictions is over here. This is where you go if you want to get equestrian.
Kitty, I feel like the Lenny Bruce of the recovery industry. I want to expose what a corrupt motherfucker.
So
thing
it's
that
not
is.
Supposed to be a business. That was not the idea.
Well, that's why I like the 401c3 idea. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think that takes that out.
Yes.
And that's the only way. Insurances will never pay because they'll constantly pressure
it down. And you don't need to have acupuncture.
No.
You need to be able to scrub your mind clean and learn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's
I'm going
it's
out
just
to Georgia.
Changed.
I'm going out to Georgia to give a talk like as soon as we finish this podcast.
Oh, really?
And that's one of the things there, you know, 12-step is under assault right now.
Yeah, it is.
Right? And we have all these medical models for treatment. And listen, I don't want to assail them because I woke up this morning thinking to myself, God, the way we do it is dangerous. It's dangerous when you go for broke, when you want people to have a full recovery and mm-hmm. and a flourishing existence again.
When you have approaching 50,000 death rate of drug overdoses.
Well, it's just dangerous.
Is it
dangerous.
Because so many people are dying of drugs that you're feeling that it's dangerous?
It's dangerous because you need really skilled people doing it. And there's a number of reasons. Really skilled people need to do it. You need to keep them for a long, long time, and often they bolt or they can't stay, whatever reason. When they go back out after having been sober for a period of time, that's when the overdoses happen. I mean, there's a lot of dangerous qualities to it.
Are you talking about the clients? Or are you talking about the people who are working?
No, the clients. The working, that's a whole other story.
So there's two things going on. Take me slow here.
The point being, was I don't want to assail the medicalization of it now because it's a bid for safety.
What about the profit off of rehab?
Hang on, that makes me insane.
That's what she's talking about.
Yeah,
it's
you have multi-million-dollar.
All right, you and I go on and on about that every damn podcast. So let's not be late.
Here's the deal. I got clean and sober in a 12-step program.
Yeah.
Okay. And
well, let me just finish my though. I'm going to Georgia to talk about all the data that shows how well 12-step works, particularly for long-term abstinence. Period. End. Go ahead.
I am not the type of person that would go, okay, well, no smart recovery. Yeah, no,
whatever works.
No, there's a lot of different approaches and ways to learn how to live your life without being 2 seconds away from a coma. Mm-hmm. And as long as that, what I can see is as long as it's run in a particular way and very carefully, because now if we do get any funding from the government, it's either going to be one or two things. One, I'm taking my butt to Washington and make some noise and say, look, we have an epidemic and we need to be able to have some funds allocated to save our future generations' lives.
I'm just imagining the team of you two at a Senate hearing. We have Lenny Bruce's daughter
and the pyromaniac
and the Lenny Bruce of recovery. Yeah.
And listen, motherfuckers.
let me do a little bit of business too, because I know both you guys have some hepatic issues, and I was thinking about our friends at Bergamet.
Would this help us?
I'll take
anything at this point.
No. Well, you would talk to your hepatologist about it. It might be, but it's not specifically.
I'm finding out more now. I'm back on track.
About getting treated?
About jumping through the hoops to get treated.
Good. Because there's no reason not to. Hep C.
$110,000 for the medication.
You're not paying it.
They're not paying it either, because I'm in some sort of remission, they say.
Yeah, and there are less, like I told you, there are alternative treatments out of there, not the big.
Oh, I can tell you stories about what's been going on with that hepatitis C medication. One is, a friend of mine was determined, same as me, that he was in remission, that his viral count was too low, he had no cirrhosis, blah, blah, blah. And you're 54 years old, so you don't qualify for the drug.
Right.
And then he comes home and he texted me like, what did they just tell me? And I said, I think they just told you you're going to die of something else before you die of hepatitis.
That's correct. That's correct. But listen, there are some combo therapies out there that are a lot less expensive. And they're pretty good. You might look into, especially if you have a responsive. Anyway, I'm not a hepatologist, but I know I keep an eye on that literature. I actually did some of the original research on it, on ribavirin.
Oh, really?
Many, many years ago. Anyway, but Bergamet Mega Plus, the guys I'm talking about. It's a nutritional supplement. I almost never go behind supplements, but this is one I am behind. It's rich in something called polyphenols.
Taking it yourself, right?
I am taking it myself. And I've recommended a couple of patients who have had issues with statins. And this is sort of a natural statin, or HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor. It's something that lowers the bad cholesterol, raises the good cholesterol. And this particular product is derived from a bergamot citrus fruit endemic in the Calabria region of Italy. And they've done a lot of research, and the Italian government has dedicated a lot of research to it. And it also works for the metabolic syndrome, you know, body weight here and high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and fatty liver. That was the part that I was interested in. I saw some remarkable research on effects on fatty liver related to high cholesterol and metabolic syndrome. So Bergamet Mega Press, check it out. The website, let me get it for you, is bergamet.com, bergamet.com. Go to thislifepodcast or doctor.com and click on the Bergamet banner on those websites. Again, cardiologists, physicians all over the world recommending it. I'm recommending it. Its effectiveness, the subject of many scientific publications, and I'm excited about this product. So I'm glad they're behind us here, and it's a privilege to be a part of them.
And we're also brought to you by Aloe Treatment Centers.
Yeah, we have good people supporting us, so that's nice. So, Kitty, tell us more about the foundation. Where do you want it to go? What do you want it to do? What do you want people to know? What should they, if they want to support it, what should they do?
How do we become board members?
Now we got to get you back.
If you want to make a financial contribution, it's totally tax deductible. And you could go to www.LennyBruceOfficial.com.
LennyBruceOfficial.com?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
What I would like to do, I would like to bring the module to you.
To me?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like you to take what you think is a good idea and see if it works.
Well, I know these models work. These social models work. The only thing I ever worry about with them is that people are getting the spectrum of needs met. In other words, no one's slipping through the cracks with significant medical or psychiatric or psychological trauma issues that don't get addressed. Now, mind you, the timing of when you treat any of these things is something of great mystery, because it's not been well worked out. Sometimes it's just getting through your thing, many times, most of the time, just getting through that social model, getting sober, learning how to live. Then in 6 months or a year or 2 years, we'll deal with the trauma. We'll deal with the other stuff.
And see, the cart is before the horse with treatment, because the insurance industry says, you should talk about trauma. You could bill for that. Like when you're on day 12, you could talk about your father abandoning you.
So what I've always done with trauma is I like to...
It comes out as you're growing.
Yeah. Well, I like to explore it. I like to sort of hear, to get a history so I know what I'm dealing with. And then I like them to discuss it in groups so they can understand they all share this. It's a common thing. Leave it. Let it sit. But they're not alone with these trauma. This is something that's a feature of, we're in an epidemic of that too, right?
But
now,
I would say the thing that Drew has helped me understand is how my childhood trauma played out in my life, and I would re-traumatize myself by what I was attracted to, by what I...
How crazy is that about the human?
It's so crazy.
It's so weird that we do that as humans. It's so
and
weird.
I think women in particular, it's hard for them to see it. It's harder. I can get guys to see it because guy trauma, they get to us... Well, I'm a guy, and that usually can relate to guys better, but guys will come to me after their third marriage and has failed and their life is a wreck and say, dude, what the fuck? And these are people 10 and 15 years sober, right? And I'll say, you might want to go talk to somebody about your childhood. That's how I direct it. Because the person is ready to figure out, I've been re-traumatizing myself. There are things about me that AA hasn't helped me understand.
You're saying yourself personally, though?
I and my friends.
Yeah.
I was one of the first people to do it, because you were around and kind of inspiring me. At 8 years sober, I started going to therapy once a week, because he told me, the therapist says, you need to come twice a week after about a month.
Of course. Well,
I think that
it's a compliment.
Drugs and alcohol should be dealt with and treated for that.
Yeah.
I think that other conditions, bipolar,
whatever,
bulimia.
Well, that dries up, really.
Sometimes that remits when you treat the addiction. Sometimes it becomes a significant issue. But again, when you do it is an art, when you go after it.
There's a lot of belief, and I think Kitty stumbled upon something that we've been talking about for years. There's a lot of belief that if you treat the bipolar,
everything else goes away.
It'll be easier to get sober. No it's not. No. Sober is fucking hard.
Yeah.
It's easier to stay sober
than it is to get sober.
And Bob, I would say treating underlying conditions that are affecting your ability to get sober can make sobriety possible.
But I think it takes away from the focus.
No, but listen,
all they do is call themselves bipolar.
I think that it's too confusing.
It's confusing.
In my town, Dr. Drew, when I would have... I worked a lot with the prison system, and the ladies would max out the last 6 months of their sentence at Lenny's house, and it was great. The state-run facilities that would hold females, let's say, would medicate them
No, that's not okay.
I mean, no, I'm really, not talking about that. So when they came to the recovery house, they said, okay, I'm going to tell you what. You're not bringing that in. You can't have that.
I'm with you 100%. Yeah. I'm talking about what's necessary to make recovery possible. There are certain conditions that make it virtually impossible to be sober. I mean, even if your blood sugar is out of control, whatever it is. I mean, it's certain things. And you know me. I'm talking about the margins, just making sure.
But I think a lot of your contemporaries want to confuse the addict population by saying it's only that.
No. Well, you know, we've been fighting that for 20 years.
And it's getting worse, just so you know. And so what you can do with a 501c3, which I like, is say, you can say, you want to be here? These are the conditions.
Right.
It's free.
Yeah.
I worked at a nonprofit for 5 years. It was one of the greatest times of my life. I had never worked in real treatment. I worked at a thing called MAP, which is Musicians Assistance Program, where they did what we wanted or get the fuck out.
And we
had a huge, very high success rate. I would say at least 20%.
That's why I got to know Bob, was that he was putting patients in my facility.
Uh-huh.
And we love treating the MAP patients. Are you kidding me?
He could kick them out because we were. I worked for a guy named Buddy Arnold who knew your dad and knew Joe Meany. Used to play music with him.
Who's Joe
Jazz
Meany?
Music.
Sax player.
Yeah.
That my father knew very, very well.
Yeah. Huh. And Philly Joe Jones and those guys.
Uh-huh.
Buddy Arnold was right in the middle of that. He was a junkie, probably with your dad in the late 50s, early 60s. And
was he a social user, too?
Yeah, he was a social user that went to prison several times.
You know.
A nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn.
So, Buddy's Jewish, too?
Buddy's Jewish, too, yeah, from Brooklyn.
Oh, that's so funny.
So Buddy Arnold got sober in 1980. And started a program for musicians. And it was initially for his friends, Woody Herman, Buddy Collette, a lot of jazz musicians from your dad's era. And they got sober. And the rock musician heroin explosion was happening in the late 80s. That included me and all my friends. And he started this program that was no bullshit. And he talked like this. We brought John Frusciante into him one time. And he goes, everybody says you're a fucking genius or something. You probably can't even read music. That's what he said to him. As he's strung out sitting there ready to get assessed to go to treatment. And he goes in his briefcase. He gets a music chart, like a sax chart or something. He throws it on his lap. And he goes, if you're such a fucking genius, read me that. And John can read music and told him, like, oh. Hunched over all high and dope sick and told him, and he grabbed it and he said, well, maybe you are a genius, but are you a junkie?
Nice.
Are you a junkie? Mm-hmm. And John said, yeah. And he goes, you want help? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, want help today? And he said, yeah. And we sent him to you that day.
I remember.
That fucking day.
I remember.
And so it was the most magical treatment thing, right?
And
that's what you're trying to talk about. And it's exciting me because you can do the right thing all the time.
It's not going to work
for everybody.
There's
a place in Denver. Denver has tremendous recovery. I've gone and spoken with them called Arapaho House.
Yeah.
Look into them. They're a community
there's
supported.
There's lots of places around.
And in Dallas, there's some places, I forget the name of some women's place. They're around. We need to all get together is the thing.
You're right in that we have to go back to doing what's right. And and I'm in a position where I can't do what's right, and that's what frustrates me.
It would be such an honor if I could.
No, we
work
want
with
you to
you
be
guys.
No, of course.
Yeah, we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure it out.
I am time is my enemy, Kitty. It's bad. But I push things on Bob to talk for him. And so I sort of become like the consultant.
He's the big gun. He's the big gun, and I do the hard stuff.
He does do the hard work.
But here's
it's the most fun.
But here's the thing. In my position, I can't, as a clinical person working in two for-profit rehabs, I can't say you don't need to be on benzos because their doctor says they need to, and then I'm restraint of trade.
Really?
I'm somebody who's not a medical professional telling a client they shouldn't be on that medicine.
Then you need to.
It's crazy,
then
right?
You need to find somebody that can. Maybe
you know,
one of your
so that's the first time I heard that was at Las Encinas from Dr. H.
Yeah,
he told me that I was restraining his trade.
Well, it's a little different than that. Hey, let's talk about how to talk dirty and influence people. Let's go back to Lenny because we have an iconic individual.
I know.
I want to talk more about history and Lenny and comedy. So, what are they going to learn by reading the book?
A different way of thinking. I think a different way of thinking. I had this book released 50 years after my father's death. And I thought, because you can even see inside, it says about the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation. But the proceeds from this, instead of me getting them, whatever the part I get can go straight to the foundation.
That's so beautiful.
You know, and that I just want to be able to make it possible that we can help as many people, as many people as we can. If I can just help one person, because it's not just them. It's their mother, their sister, their daughter, their aunt, their uncle, their son, their
it's
brother,
everybody.
Their father.
I wonder if
it's,
you could start it.
It's everybody.
You could start it like a comedy musician's assistant.
Well, that's
program.
The other thing that we so now it's 21st century,
so
right?
So that's why it's a good idea to buy this book.
So here's
but,
another fun thing.
I think it'd be
thing.
A great thing if you could get also.
But we've been doing that.
But how about women that have been in the stripping or stretch trade or something, sort of fold
yeah, the,
them
Sharon
into
Mitchell
this.
Already has that foundation. We
yeah, I know Sharon
right?
Mitchell, but yeah, kind of.
But
maybe
here's
they,
what
maybe
here's
the
what happens.
Got to get together.
Here's what happens. Comedians are notoriously competitive with one another, though they're friendly. Drew and I love comedy. We went in New York and comedy, and it's so weird. Afterwards, they all just sit at a table and don't talk to each other.
No, they'll turn on each other.
No, so it was Bob.
They're beta fish.
Listen to this table. Who's the guy from?
Aziz.
Well, yeah, Aziz Ansari.
And the guy from Mad Men.
The guy from Mad Men, the bad boss.
They had just done the Comedy Cellar, and then we're meeting them afterwards.
Artie.
They're all just sitting at a table.
Artie
like,
Lang.
Angry,
we had Artie
writing
Lang.
Things down.
Is Artie and Aziz. And Aziz, I go, your dad really a gastroenterologist? And now he's on the show, and he is really a gastroenterologist.
Yeah.
And I go, Aziz, I know your dad. I know about 50 of them. Yeah. I know that guy. And he was... Not
they're
talk
just
about
they're just not that funny in real life. Like you said, your dad was withdrawn or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what
oh, geez,
happens
I've been dealing
is
dealing with that with Corolla for 20 years.
What happens is they're such independent contractors. They're not a unity like there is with musicians. Musicians really are in competition with each other, but they respect each other, and there's this camaraderie of amongst
not
musicians
so
and knots in comedy.
No.
So every time a comedian dies of drugs, everybody kind of rallies around and contacts me because I'm friends with a bunch of comedians. Mm-hmm. We should start a Comedy Cares like you had at MAP.
Yeah.
The last two comedians that have died, everybody, I'm also the guy that gets all the comedians' calls. I've helped a lot of comedians because they know I love comedy and whatever. So we've talked for years about starting Comedy Cares. Jerry, what's his? The
Seinfeld?
Seinfeld knows about it. Louis certainly knows about it. Chris Rock wants to do it. Everybody wants to start a drug program
but
a helping program.
Kitty is
non-profit
such a, I know,
for,
but Kitty
she
is
would
such
be
a
the
great
icon.
Figure, and I,
she
right,
could be
she
the
a
icon.
Great figurehead. We could sort of organize it around
because
her. And
it,
she knows what she's talking about, which is nice.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That you know the what we're trying to
you
do.
The beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you could be the Buddy Arnold.
No, don't
the
make
mom.
Her. No,
oh,
no, no.
Good. You get
no.
to throw no. music.
Kitty,
I mean.
Kitty, don't
you
do it.
Say, are you a junkie?
No. Bob.
Pick me.
Trust me, you don't want to be in that job. Put Bob in that job.
He was the greatest guy. It was unbelievable. And that place helped how many thousands of people? I was there. We did 460 people in 1 year. 460 clients in 1 year, Matt paid for.
Yeah, but I see something big here. If we could just sort of start it that way and maybe use it as a model to reproduce in other ways.
There's a reason that I didn't die. There's a reason you didn't die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it.
Well, the reason I know both you guys, and I'm privileged to do so, to be here and to been a part of your life forever, and now to know Kitty is part of it. So we'll see where this all goes. We got to wrap this up, yes. But do you want any Lennyology questions before we do? Because I'm so fascinated. I always knew you were dabbling and liked
he
him.
He knows more about my dad, I think, than I do.
He's obsessed. I didn't know. Do you have any questions?
It's kind of crazy. You ever heard the song Lenny Bruce by Bob Dylan?
Yes.
Do you cry?
Yes.
I do too. Mm-hmm. There's a song that Bob Dylan wrote about her dad that's amazing.
Maybe we should wrap it with Kitty. Tell us what, you know, give us a sense of where you think he fits. You know, what is the role he played? And I would say, and I don't want to say in the history of comedy or music, we sort of articulated that a little bit, but I feel he was important.
American culture.
And I would like to know where you think he fits.
I think that my father fits in a place that respects and takes care of what and who is in their life and around. My father wanted a kinder, gentler world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he stood up and he could have passed. He could have not done his act, you know, and stayed alive. Okay? But he's to be learned from.
I always thought he wants other people to be like him in the sense that they don't tolerate the intolerable. Is that accurate, or is that, or does that make it too not? I don't know.
I don't know why my father did what he did, but I can tell you that he had an obsession with when he knew that something was unjust, he wouldn't let go. It's like trying to take a bone from a he just wouldn't let
go. Think about that. Do we make people like that anymore?
Well, but I'm thinking about you and your antisocial stuff. but listen, antisocial has a flip side, which is sort of pro-social. Yeah. And maybe we should really think about harnessing that, you know? Because a lot of antisocial feelings out there in the world today. How do you flip that into a pro-social?
This is certainly no Woodstock over here.
Yeah, that. But I try to carry on in that way of I got to look out for myself, but I want to look out for the injustice too. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a tradition that's been around for all of American history.
Yes, it is.
But it's going away.
I kind of feel like we've been in a little bit of it, and it's been so negative and so hostile and aggressive. What I hear you saying about your dad is he wants that to be people not being that way, not needing mm-hmm. to be that way.
Exactly.
And so I'm just wondering if...
Well, but you can make it funny, though. It is funny. Like, Trump is funny. Come on.
Oh, my God. Comedians are going to... They'll never be happier. He's in the White House. Oh my God!
It's funny
when he's where?
I said if. I didn't say when.
You scared me.
I'm just saying it's a possibility. It's still a possibility. I know it seems ridiculous, but it's still a possibility.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Like, I don't know. I just always thought your dad was in the right place at the right time, and people of his generation stood up and did the right thing. My dad did. Mm-hmm. Many dads did of that generation. And somehow he was in the middle of this zeitgeist about race, about hypocrisy, about religion, at the change. And
here's the thing that he doesn't like.
I think your dad started the conversation about mm-hmm. change,
yeah.
and then it got ruined by the 70s.
Yes.
The 70s ruined a lot of people.
Yeah, no, I think to put a finer point on, I think the 60s knocked it off the rail and then the 70s ruined it.
Because a lot of the icons your dad's, I think of more as the 50s, but the 50s icons and 60s icons, a lot of them passed away from
drugs. Well, they were onto something. And I think in a way the hipster thing is kind of a picking back up.
And if you think about
that.
The year that your father died is the year that Bob Dylan checked out of society. He just said, no more, I'm not a spokesperson for fucking anything,
right.
Because he recognized I'm not going to die for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? This is signing up for a fucking heavy.
All right,
rap.
You guys, we are going to have to. Speaking of rap, we're going to have to wrap this.
Thank
up.
Thank you so much, Privilege
Kitty.
I
hope you'll
to your show.
So
hope, great. To both of you.
Hope you'll be
so
in our
fun.
Life,
we'll
and hope we'll
again.
Figure something out. It's not going to be quick or easy, but I have faith in you guys. So I know, and I know the need is there. You know, like any mm-hmm. entrepreneur, the idea is solving a
build
problem.
Build it and they will come.
Well, it's problem solving, and there certainly is a problem. And if we could just figure out some solutions, I think we'd be on to it. So
more jobs, less belly button gazing.
There
all right, you guys.
Go.
We will. Thank you, Kitty. The book is called How to Talk Dirty, Influence People. Get it at DrDrew.com. Go to LennyBruceOfficial.com. If you want. It's just Lenny Bruce Official. Not the Lenny Bruce Official, but Lenny Bruce Official.
LennyBruceOfficial.com.
The
foundation
to the website.
Is the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation.
But you can get to the foundation from the
there.
And follow Kitty at The Real Kitty Bruce. And it's been a privilege. We'll see you next time.
There you go.
Thank you.
I am host of my own podcast, The Paul Mercurio Show on the Sideshow Network. All right, listen, I want you to give a little listen here to Lenny Bruce. Lenny, any comic will tell you, probably even going back to Richard Pryor, has been an influence on everybody in this business, and kind of had two careers, worked in strip clubs as sort of a real roadie, you know, kind of down and dirty comic, and then transformed himself into this unbelievable social satirist, and you just can't help but hear him and then hear strains of him and pretty much all of the heavy hitter comedians that have come down the line since him. And he's a big influence, and if you don't know about him, you should, so that's why I'm putting him on my list. Lenny Bruce, everybody.
Thing snapping on Rappamon station. Yeah. Hey, they give you the same schlepping of dopey dopamine around. Okay, no, we're not after you, we're after the seller. They got four dopamines. The federal gets them, the state takes them, and the city gets them. Okay, I'll be the seller this week, you're the dopey. Okay. And the schmuck is waiting in the restaurant. Okay, which, well, he was a Puerto Rican, he had a green car. Airplane glue. Airplane glue. Kid is 6 years old. And played by George McCready. And it's a prison film now. Charles Bickford, Barton McLean, Georgie Stone, Frankie Darrow, Weinheimer, Nat Pendleton, and the woman across the bay, Anne Dvorak. The two hooker friends, Iris Adrian. And a word about hookers that they're very disappointing, always. Because Jews are always hungry after they shtup and there's nothing in the icebox ever. Hooker's icebox is a club soda and that's it. Nothing to eat, eh? The orchid, all right, wait then. Now the Tower of the Warden, Hume Croon. And there's, you got 18 men, prison guards. There's one guy got a steel plate in his head. They're sitting on the rooftops with magnets picking him up. Bing, bang. The warden. All right, Dutch. This is the warden. You've got 18 men down there, prison guards, who serve me faithfully. Give up, and we'll meet any reasonable bands you guys want, except the vibrators. Can you hear us? Yada, yada. Yada, 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 one. Never mind those Louis Armstrong impressions. Give up, you're a rotten, vicious criminal. Now the handsome but mixed-up prison doctor, Sabu. Don't kiss him, warden. I like you, don't you know that? Don't you know that the rent of Rancho Bull cuts you and hurts you? I like that.
Get out of here, spick ass.
All right, leave me alone. Don't talk to me that way. You jab, you jab.
Will you stop bugging me, Dutch? We're going to start killing you. Yada, yada. Shut up, you putz. I got a headache, yada, yada. You need with these people. Just kill them. Kill about 20 down there. It'll shape up. Just a moment. Before there's any kidding, I'll get down there. Not you, Father Plotsky. Father, you don't understand that these guys are monsters. On every mattress, they got a knife and a gun. Son, you seem to forget, don't you, that I think stronger than knives and guns. You mean, that's right, jujitsu. And that's it.
All right, that was Lenny Bruce. Love him.